Hello, Ready Gang. Welcome back to the Active Self-Protection Podcast. I am yet again your host, Mike Wolliver, and I remain your favorite former Fed. With us today, a new friend, not a new friend of mine. We have known Lisa on Facebook, but not in real life for a while. She is in the Portland, Oregon area, and she is the Chief Range Safety Officer and an FI, a firearms instructor. Sorry, I always try to explain the internal jargon. Firearms instructor, and she is the owner of her own company called PacWest Defense. Lisa, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on. As I say every time, if it weren't for people like you, I wouldn't have a show. It would just be me talking for an hour and nobody would watch that, I'm afraid. So thank you very much. So your story revolves, the story you're going to tell today revolves largely around domestic violence. Domestic violence is one of those things where I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconception about how it works, how the power dynamic works, how and why people stay in bad situations after everyone else around them thinks they should have bailed out. There's a lot to uncover. It's a very sensitive topic. So if you're listening to this and you have that in your history, just I want to give you a sort of a warning ahead of time. That's the main gist of the talk in case you don't want to listen to this, but I think you probably should keep listening. So Lisa, tell us, you're now in the self-defense world, you know, the kind of circles that me and John and Steph run in. When all this stuff was going on in your past, I take it this was all, none of that stuff was going on. You weren't a self-defense oriented person or a firearms instructor.
That's correct. That came much, much later.
Okay. So talk to us about these situations. I mean, you start with anything you want to start with. I'm going to let you kind of have free rein here. I don't have a script. I don't do a lot of pre-interview. So kind of walk us through the earliest things that went on and kind of how that went for you.
Okay. Well, I guess the easiest thing for me is just to lay out like a quick 10-second overview of everything and then kind of go back chronologically.
Sure.
As a young child, there was a person who would repeatedly break into the house to visit my mom, you can say, to politely say it. And that went on for a while until my dad found out. Fast forward several years, my brother and I were talking to my mom about dreams and nightmares and things like that. And I shared a recurring nightmare that I had had as a child. And she informed me that that was not a nightmare, but in fact, those were memories. And so that was quite a realization. When I was 18, my parents got divorced and moved out of the house, sold the house. And so I was on my own to support myself at 18. And was involved with a guy who was a bit older, and ended up in a 7-year-long abusive relationship with him. After I managed to escape that situation, a couple of years goes by, and then I find myself, just by the grace of God, just missing an active shooter situation at one of the local malls. And so with all that stuff combined and a few other things in the middle, it just got to the point where it was time for me to get serious about gun training and self-defense. And that's how I got into the industry.
Yeah. Just as an aside, it occurs to me, this is anecdotal. I've done a couple hundred of these interviews of self-defenders, and almost always when it comes to a female self-defender who has a story to tell, not always, but almost always, there is a catalyzing event at some point. There was something that sort of gave them the idea, okay, I am actually responsible for my own self-defense, for no one's coming to my rescue. I have to prepare myself to protect me, to protect my children, or whatever the case may be. Whereas men tend to come to that understanding sort of naturally. I don't know. In your experience, because you're an instructor as well, is that your experience as well, that women generally have an event or something that goes on that sort of draws them in that direction?
Absolutely. Almost every time. If it's not the student, and I work with men and women, but I do work a lot with women, especially for the females, if it's not them who have personally suffered from a violent encounter, it's somebody very close to them who has... Mm-hmm. suffered a violent encounter. And in some cases, in just the last couple of years in the Portland area, there's been a lot of violence, rioting, Antifa, and things like that. And so just some of it has been seeing what's happening on the news that has scared people into wanting to defend themselves. But it's always something that they have seen close to them or that they've experienced personally.
Yeah. And so to like double digress now, I'm sorry to get too far afield here, but you live in the Portland area. I've had other people on the show who've given me various accounts of what it's like there. So just really quick, is going through downtown Portland still this gauntlet that the news makes it out to be, or is it not really that bad?
Well, I drive through Portland twice a day to get to work. Mm-hmm. And I do my best to not get off the surface streets and stay on the highway, but there for a while, it was really, really, really sketchy. Protests, groups of people getting violent with cars, with pedestrians, people throwing rocks and bricks over overpasses at cars. Lately, it has quieted down. Now, I don't drive through Portland or go downtown at night. Usually morning and evening rush hour, but it can still be quite questionable. There's a lot of homeless people, many of whom are high on something, right, and can still get aggressive or violent. And I have had to get off the freeway and detour through downtown Portland a couple of times, or just cut through an edge of downtown Portland. And I'm grateful to be locked inside my car. Let's just right. say that I wouldn't want to be walking through some of these neighborhoods. And this is all fairly new to the Portland area in the last 3, 4, 5 years. Before that, it was pretty a nice place, a clean, attractive place to go and spend your time. And now it's pretty sketchy. And you might see on the news, a lot of big companies and stores are pulling up their roots and just ditching Portland altogether because, you know, windows are getting broke, customers are getting harassed, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a shame because I've never been to Portland or Seattle for that matter. But my impression of it historically was it was a cool, kind of funky, strange, you know, liberal, but not leftist, you know, kind of liberal haven and, you know, artsy and coffee shops and all. And it seemed like somewhere I'd like to visit, but unfortunately that's no longer the case. So anyway, enough about Portland. It's not why we're here. So why don't you just walk us through this first relationship? First of all, the fact that you were out on your ear at 18, that's not a great start. And that, by the way, is a pretty common theme with people that I used to arrest with some frequency, was parents kind of just really abandoned them and let them go, you know, at a young age, 13, 14, 15, they were on the street or couch surfing or whatever. And that's a thing that's very indicative of having problems, whether it's being dependent on someone you don't want to be dependent on because you don't have a lot of options, or ending up in, you know, doing crime, basically becoming a criminal out of necessity. So kind of walk us through that situation. You're 18, your parents sell the house. They say, okay, you're on your own, kid. How did that go down?
Yeah, pretty much just like that. My dad, had been a pretty heavy alcoholic. I guess once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, right?
Right.
But he'd been a pretty heavy drinker, and my parents fought since the day I was born. They were fighting, and my mom decided to wait until I was 18. I was the youngest of two kids. I have an older brother. And once I turned 18, my mom was like, okay, I can't handle it anymore. You're old enough to be on your own. She asked for a divorce. They sold the house, and that was it. You know, my dad went to go live with his brother, my uncle. My brother went to go live with my cousin. My mom moved in with my grandma. Most of them were couch surfing for a little while. And I didn't really have anywhere to go. Being just turning 18, some of my friends were still 17. Some of my friends were still 19 or 20. All of them still living at home with their parents.
Right.
And, you know, I had a job, two jobs, in fact, but a minimum wage job at $3 and, you know, 75 cents an hour or what have you, $4 an hour. There was no way I could afford rent on my own for that. The guy that I had been dating, he was 6 and a half, 7 years older. and you know, had his own place. And so my mom had suggested, why don't you go move in with him? You know, he's got his own place. And we had only been together for, you know, seeing each other for 3-4 months, maybe. And I wasn't really keen on the idea of moving in with a boyfriend, especially someone I didn't, you know, hadn't been with for terribly long, but
right.
I really couldn't have, I didn't have any other options. There was no other option for me. So I moved in with him, and I was financially dependent on him because he made the bulk of the income and I helped out where I could. I could manage to pay for my car payment. I could manage to pay for my insurance, a few $100 a month for rent and groceries, but nowhere close to, you know, supporting myself without a couple of roommates. And none of my friends were in the position to move out or had wanted to. So I was kind of stuck. And that's when things kind of started to get ugly, because he knew I really had nowhere to go and could get away with an awful lot.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Rarely do these scenarios start out with someone showing their abusive side right off the bat. Normally it's all sunshine and rainbows up front. And these sorts of things, in my experience, happen incrementally, where it's a raised voice, you know, the first time that you're not used to that. And then once the abuser realizes, okay, I can do that, I can raise my voice, and this person will cower, or this person won't correct me. And then it just gets incrementally worse and worse and worse. Was that your experience, or was it sort of an all of a sudden type of a thing?
No, you're absolutely right. It was incrementally. It started out with little things here and there, followed by an apology, and just started to escalate in frequency and intensity. And the guy was an excellent con man. I mean, my family and friends loved him. He was
That's always the case.
He was a charmer. And I'd mention, look, we got into a fight, you know, he said this or he did that. And, you know, my friends would be like, oh, well, that sucks. But, you know, at least he apologized, right? You guys got over it. And so it was just one of those things where it happened slow enough that I was adjusting to it. Right. It's like if you're on your weight loss journey and you lose a pound a week and you look at yourself in the mirror and you don't see a lot of change, but somebody you haven't seen in a year suddenly sees you after 8 months. They're like, wow, you changed so much. Abuse often goes that way. It's just little bits here and there. And so you get accustomed to it, and that's just the normal. Right. And then one day you open your eyes, turn around, and you're like, how did I get here?
Right.
How did this get so bad? Because it wasn't just one day, everything just flipped upside down. It was just a little bit at a time.
Yeah. And I don't know the psychology of an abuser. Almost always someone who exhibits that behavior was abused themselves. Doesn't excuse anything, but I'm just saying almost always there was that was their role model, was, you know, a dad or, you know, baby daddy or whatever that does that sort of thing. And they probably tell themselves, I'll never do that. I won't be that way. And, you know, the analogy I like is the frog, you know, in the warm water on the stove, and you just start turning the water up a little bit at a time. Next thing you know, he's like, how did I get in this boiling water? And at which point it becomes exponentially more difficult to extricate yourself from that situation, because not only are you dependent on the person, you start to see this as normal. This becomes normalized, this behavior, the yelling and screaming. But when it turns, I think what most people don't understand, who've never been around anyone who does this sort of thing, anyone who is abusive physically or mentally or verbally, is they don't understand how it goes from, okay, yelling's one thing, but when, you know, the minute someone raises a hand to me, you know, I'm out the door or whatever. Do you remember the first time that it went from, you know, emotional and verbal abuse to physical abuse?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And what would you say to someone who's like, well, why didn't you just leave? What do you say to that person? Because I think people will ask that question, and there's a big misunderstanding, in my opinion.
Yeah. We were in bed sleeping, or at least I was sleeping. And I rolled over and I don't know, my dream or something, I smacked him or elbowed him or something in my sleep without realizing it. And he responded by turning around and punching me several times. And I come out of a sleep going, what's going on? And he just completely lost it and stormed out of the bedroom. Came back in a minute later, grabbed his gun, which he had had underneath the bed, verified that it was loaded, stopped and looked at me with it in his hand. And then he turned around and walked back out of the end of the living room again. And I was absolutely terrified. I thought I need to get out of here, but the only way to get out without walking past him was climbing out the bedroom window. And it was a duplex, right? So I would have had to open the window, pop out the screen, climb out the window, and then shimmy over the neighbor's fence. They had a dog in the backyard in order to try and get out. And I just thought, well, it was in the middle of the night. Like, well, where am I going to go at, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning, even if I did get out? So I just laid there terrified, wondering, what was going to happen next. He ended up sleeping in the living room. And the next morning, I kind of tiptoed out, and first he actually acted like nothing was wrong. Like everything was totally normal. And when I was just avoiding eye contact with him, avoiding talking to him, and then just giving really short responses when he did try to talk to me, he basically said, look, last night was a startled reaction that I had to you hurting me. And if you're not going to be able to get over this, then you can get the hell out now. You can go find somewhere else to live, but you're going to have to figure out how to get past this. And that was his response.
Basically blaming you. Like, if you have a problem with this, which you obviously shouldn't. That's pretty common as well, as I'm sure you know.
Right, right. It was his startled response to me. It was because I initiated something in my sleep. And so I just couldn't figure out how to wrap my brain around that. And I told a friend a couple of days later, and my friend was like, Lisa, why, if that really happened, why would you still be there? And it was like, oh,
by the way, the key element of that is being, if that really happened, which is just a slap in the face.
Right, right. Because my whole life I had been a fairly strong person, strong-willed person, and not one to take, a lot of flack from people. Mm-hmm. And like I said, this guy was a charmer. And so when I started trying to talk to people about it and ask for help, it just didn't make sense in their heads why this nice guy would be acting this way and why someone like me would be tolerating that sort of behavior. And I found over the next couple of years, when I tried to talk to people about it, I was met with similar responses. It was like, oh, they realized, okay, maybe they had a fight, maybe something got a little bit out of hand, but there's no way it was that bad. I must be exaggerating. And so I got to a point where I just kind of gave up asking for help, because it just seemed like nobody was going to help. Nobody was really believing the extent of what was happening.
Yeah. The problem is, and this is my opinion, I'm editorializing, a big part of the problem is that people don't want there to be a problem ever in any situation. They don't want to upset the apple cart. So that's why all kinds of abuse goes unreported, is because it's like, well, if we do, then we have, everything's going to change. I got to find a new place to live. And the people on the outside tend to want to brush things under the rug unless they're forced to deal with stuff. And it's unfortunate, but I think would you agree that it's sort of just human nature for people to do that?
It's been a pattern that I've seen. A lot of people just want to believe that this stuff doesn't happen in their lives. It doesn't happen to them and people that they know. The whole ostrich head in the sand analogy. Mm-hmm. It's just easier to pretend that there isn't a problem than there is to address a problem and deal with it.
Yeah, and I would say
with intimate relationships and private relationships too, a lot of people don't want to get involved in that because it's a he said, she said, who do they believe? And, you know, your relationship is not my business. And so that makes it a little harder.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this and, you know, you aren't in an abusive relationship, I hope you're not, by the way, but you know someone who was telling you things like this, it really isn't incumbent upon you. Here's your mental rep for this, you know, the lesson for this story is, if you're not in an abusive relationship, but someone is telling you that they are, just take them seriously. I'm not a fan of any of these sort of dogmatic slogans that have come out in the last few years. Like, I think believe all women was a thing. It's like, well, no. Don't believe all anyone about anything. Take everyone seriously. When they come to you and say, hey, there's a problem, take them seriously and don't brush it under the rug. Don't try to normalize it or make excuses or rationalize. If they're telling you something's going on and they're asking for your help, or they're insinuating that they want your help without asking, take them seriously and look into it and help that person. Don't just, I keep using the under the rug analogy, but that's the best one. Don't just pretend like it's not there. Like Stephanie Widener says, you have to radically accept reality in a critical incident. You know, if something's happening, the sooner you realize that it's happening and accept that, the sooner you can start to do whatever it is you need to do to get yourself out of that situation. And that in a odd way, that applies here as well. Like if you have a friend who's coming to you saying, hey, this is happening at my house, you need to take them seriously and help them however you can. How long did you end up with this same person, and how did you extricate yourself from this relationship?
We were together about 6.5 years. And at one point I decided I was going to try to get away, and I applied for a Disney internship in Florida, and got accepted. And I thought, okay, this is my chance to get away. So I took my cat over to my aunt's house and said, you know, hey, this is a 9-month program. Can you watch my cat while I'm gone? And then when I get back and I get settled, I'll come and get her. And she was like, oh yeah, sure. No problem. And so I grabbed a giant duffel bag, packed all of as much as I could into one giant duffel bag, got on an airplane and flew to Florida, not knowing a single person. And, thought, okay, this was it. I'm done. I'm free. And I was there, a few months, maybe halfway through the program, when he started calling me and, texting me and wanting to know how things were going, what I was doing, was I going to come back for a visit, and just tried to behave like everything was fine. Like I was on vacation and I would be home soon. And I was trying to ignore him. And finally one day I just responded and I was like, I'm not coming home anytime soon. I may stay here when I'm done. If I can find a job here, I might do that. And then fast forward, you know, a couple of weeks maybe, and it's about 5:30 in the morning and I'm sleeping and I get a call from the guard station. And these were private apartment buildings, right? Guards at the gate. And, you had to either live there and show proof that you lived there, or you had to be on a guest list with 24 hours notice before a guest was allowed on the property. Mm-hmm. And, I get a call from the guard station that there's some guy downstairs, like starting an issue with the guard, and that I need to come down and handle it. And they wouldn't let him in, because he wasn't on the visitors list. He didn't know what apartment number I was in. He just knew that the name of the apartment. And so I went down and I asked him like what was going on. And he was getting into a fight with the guard at that point. They had actually like called the police and sent him, you know, chased him off. And the guard basically said, look, this is your guest and your guest is getting into fights. So you need to pack your stuff and get out. You need to go. Like, you can't be here anymore. And so he calls me, from down the street, and he's like, I've got my cat Jasmine. He says, I've got Jasmine with me. And if you don't come out and meet me, I'm throwing her to the alligators. And so I was like, well, guess what? They just kicked me out. So you're going to have to come and pick me up. And so I grabbed my stuff, and within, you know, a half hour, I drug all my possessions out to the front gate and down the street a ways. And he came and picked me up. And I was back with him at that point. I had nowhere to go. I had no job, nowhere to live. And so we just started driving back across the country, back towards home.
Can I just editorialize for a moment about the guards? I don't understand anything about what you just said. Doesn't make any sense to me. Why on earth, your job as the guard is to prevent unauthorized people from coming in. Why would I call the female, a young female resident, to tell her to come deal with this? You should have been able to say, yeah, I don't, that's my ex. I don't want him anywhere near me. Tell him to go away. Like, why they involved you is incredible to me. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Anyway, yeah, but you end up back with him. How much longer and how bad does it get before you're able to get out of there again? And again, as you're comfortable, if you don't want to talk about anything in particular, you just tell me, it's fine.
No, it got interesting. I think we were together maybe a year. We started driving back across the country and stopped in Phoenix to visit a friend and ended up staying there. He didn't want to go back to Oregon right away. And so he's like, we can live anywhere, move anywhere. Where do you want to go? And I just wanted to go home and back to Oregon. And he was like, well, we're going to sightsee along the way. Stopped in Phoenix to see some friends, ended up staying there for a few months. And that's where things kind of started to get interesting. He was not a great guy to start with, and had been buying and selling weed before weed was legal. Mm-hmm. And he had had a fairly nice car that he had sold to the guy he was buying his weed from, and decided he was going to go back and take the car back. So in the middle of the night, he had an extra set of keys, a second key. He went and stole the car back from the guy he had sold it to, and then drove it across the country and picked me up in it. So I didn't even know that I was getting into a stolen car. We drove it back across the country into Arizona, and he wanted immediately to ditch the car. And he kept trying to get me to co-sign for him so we could use that car as a trade-in to buy something else. And I refused. I wanted nothing to do with it. And he ended up trading in this car for a used 4Runner. And in Oregon, you don't get the title to your car until it's paid for completely. Then they mail you the physical title. In Arizona, at least back then, the DMV asked you, like, is the car leased or owned? And he told them it was owned when it was still being financed. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they didn't check, but they ended up giving him the title to the car, even though the finance company still owed. And so I don't really know exactly how that happened. I tried to not get involved in the whole thing. But so he had the title to this car that he didn't actually own. And then he sold it to someone else, right? There was a dad bought it for his young son. Mm-hmm. And then he's got this Toyota 4Runner. And eventually we drive back to Oregon. And once we got back to Oregon, things were just really ugly, and you know, it was bad. But he took off one day, and I was home by myself, and I get a knock on the door, and there's a private investigator from Arizona looking for him.
Mm-hmm. Because I wonder why.
The guy who's his kid got the car repossessed.
Yeah.
So the finance company tracked down the car, repossessed it. And so the dad hired an investigator to go find my ex and mm-hmm. hunt him down and get, you know, I don't know what the intention was after that, but to find him. And that just rattled me so bad. that there was a PI knocking on my door. And I didn't know any of this had happened until the PI showed up and explained it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly thereafter, I got a job working at Subway, and just to get a job and working the night shift. And the night shift, you know, you're in the store by yourself until 11 o'clock at night. And this guy started coming in on a regular basis, and he just gave me the creeps. Well, as it turns out, this guy that kept coming in was the guy who's was the drug dealer of my ex. He was the guy who got the car stolen from him. And so he found me looking for me to try to get to the ex. And I started getting threatening voicemails on my phone. He would call and say, "Hey, Lisa, you know, I like the way you got your hair done today," and then describe, you know, the way I had my hair or the color of my polo shirt. And I didn't really realize that the guy that was coming in was this guy until he called me and says, like, "I'm sitting in the parking lot right now looking at you. Thanks for just making me this, you know, this sandwich." And I realized, oh, well, that's the guy, and he wants me to know that he's out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he didn't believe that I wasn't involved in it. And so at that point, I finally convinced my dad and my brother that I need help moving out. And at this point, I was moving into my grandmother's place where my mom still was. and they shuffled some space around, and I was able to get into a bedroom in my grandma's house. So my dad and my brother came over to help me move out. And I had he was gone when they were there helping me move out, and they were parked in the back lot and taking stuff in and out, and they had just gone out the back door when he walked in the front and didn't realize that they were there, and saw that a lot of the stuff was gone. Clearly I was moving out. And so he grabbed me, he had me by the throat up against the wall. And that's when my dad walked in the back door and actually saw him with his hands on my throat. and I think that was what it finally took for my family to actually believe that the stuff that I was saying wasn't over dramatized. So he saw my dad and immediately backed off, and my dad sent me outside so he could deal with it. And I don't know what was said, but he basically told my ex to stop bothering me and leave me alone. And he mostly did. He was kind of afraid of my dad. So I kind of tried to go on and live my life, but this guy, the drug dealer, would still call me sometimes and harass me. And, one day I had had enough. He basically called and said that he knew where I was living. He knew my grandma's address. He knew that I was there with my mom and my grandma, and that if I didn't help him find my ex, that he was going to come after my family. And I kind of lost it at that point. It was one thing to threaten me. I guess I figured I could handle that. But it was crossing a line to threaten my mom and my grandma, you know, this little old lady, you know. It was, so I kind of lost it. I went off on the guy, and he laughed at me and thought I was cute. And then a couple weeks goes by, and I'm walking out of a Circuit City, and he's standing against my car, like leaning up against my car, thinking that, you know, if he came and saw me in person, I'd spill and hand over. Excuse me. Can you cut that?
Sure. Don't worry about it.
So I wasn't going to be intimidated at that point. So, and I could tell by his body language and the facial expression that he was looking forward to giving me a pretty hard time. So I kind of went crazy on him, and I started threatening him, saying, like, if you ever come near me, if you ever threaten to kill me, you could threaten to kill my family again, you're not going to survive that. You don't get to threaten, you know, you don't get to do death threats and get away with it. You don't know me. You don't know my family. You don't know who my dad knows, and you're making a really big mistake. So I don't ever want to see or hear from you again, because you're messing with the wrong family. And, he wasn't quite sure how to react to that. But at this point I was making quite a scene, and there were, you know, people in the parking lot that were stopping to stare. So he finally just kind of turned around and walked away. And that was mostly the end of that. I think he realized at that point that I was no longer with him, and I didn't know where to find him, and that threatening me or scaring me wasn't going to result in anything beneficial to him other than maybe proving a point. So that eventually just kind of ended on its own.
So I know, I know there are people listening to this right now and they're screaming at me, Mike, ask her, why didn't she just give up the ex to this guy and let him go do whatever he was going to do? I think it's probably a valid question. So why, it sounds like you're almost protecting him. Why didn't you just say, yeah, he lives at 123 Main Street and, you know, be done with it?
Well, I didn't know where he was at that point.
Oh, okay.
When I left and when I moved out, I just bailed, and he knew that a PI was looking for him, so he moved too.
Oh, okay, I got you.
I didn't know where he had moved to.
Because I would have loved to see you go, yeah, he's over at 989 West Maple apartment too.
Yeah.
Go get him.
Yeah. You
know? But unfortunately, yeah. No, that wasn't possible.
He took off because the PI was looking for him, so he didn't stay in that apartment. So I didn't know where to find him.
Now, in my LE experience, and this is a sad thing to say, but it's true. You see women who go from one relationship like this to another. Were you able to stay away from this sort of thing, or did it end up happening again? Because it just seems like almost the mentality being, you know, I deserve this. You know, I deserve this treatment. You know, this is, I have it coming, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that was your headspace at any point during this, but did you end up in any other relationships like this, or was this one enough?
That one was enough for me. It was 6 years of hell. No, I ended up, when I was ready to date again, I ended up meeting a nice, you know, a nice guy that was completely different. And I've learned since then to watch for certain personality characteristics and just
sure.
Avoid narcissists and psychopaths. And learn to recognize that behavior. And I'm probably a bit more reactive than I should be, but I have no tolerance for a temper. I have no tolerance for angry or aggressive behavior towards me at all. And I don't think that anybody really should tolerate that. I know that people get mad sometimes, people argue sometimes, but I have very little patience for it. And if, you know, the first sign of anger that I've seen in a relationship, I'm just like, all right, bye. You right. Don't get to yell at me ever, never. So it's been although I've completely walked away from that, I probably am more unforgiving than I should be to people who are completely innocent and not related to that in any way.
Probably not. I think you're probably fine. And I think there is a difference. And I think everyone listening will know what I mean when I finish this thought. A person can get upset or even angry without anyone in the room feeling threatened by them, without anyone feeling like, oh no, I'm about to get hit or they're about to blow up. Anger is anger, and anger, the nicest person on the planet can experience anger. But there's just that edge, that tinge to it, that edge to it from someone like your ex. And I think you know what I mean, where you're like, yeah, this is a problem. I don't feel safe anymore because this person is angry in this way. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So right now there could be a young person who is in a situation like you were in. And maybe it's just starting, or maybe they're noticing signs. What would you say if that person called you on the phone right now and said, hey, my boyfriend blows up at me a lot. and he's balled up his fist a couple times, but he's never hit me. Like, what would you say to that person? What advice would you give them if you could?
Run and don't look back. Threatening behavior, intimidating behavior is never acceptable. It's never okay, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you said, even the nicest guy on the planet can get angry. But threatening behavior is something else entirely. And look for other signs too. It's not just physical abuse. It can be mental, emotional, financial abuse. And when you find yourself trapped, you can't get out because you can't afford to, the other person is controlling the finances, controlling the way you spend your money, controlling who you can and cannot interact with,
mm-hmm.
your being movements. Insulting. Yeah, exactly. You know, throwing things, them breaking things, them punching walls, saying mean, hurtful things, telling mm-hmm. you what you can and cannot wear, who you can and cannot see, you know, where you can and cannot work, restricting you from seeing family. These are all things that are giant red flags. And people tend to brush those off. But you can't. You have to look at the bigger picture and see if these things are happening in addition to other things. Because there are a lot of different forms of abuse and laughing, belittling, making fun of, or making an inappropriate joke that makes you feel sad or scared, and then coming back and saying, "Oh, it was just a joke. Lighten up." But that sort of thing keeps happening. You know, that's abuse too. That's emotional abuse, and none of it is okay.
Something I just realized as you were talking, you know, I don't have nearly as much experience as local law enforcement who responds to DV incidents as a lot of other cops. You know, I was a federal agent for most of my career. What I do have experience in, however, is human trafficking. And it's funny to me, not funny. I think it's interesting how many of the things that you just listed are identical to what a human trafficker does to their person they're trafficking. Hold their ID, you know, don't let them go here. Don't let them go there. Control what they wear, control what they, you know, who they interact with, cut them off from family. All those things are remarkably similar. That's not a proponent. It occurred to me that that's something that it never occurred to me before, but there is definitely a lot of similarities between the two. So there was another incident. You mentioned a mass shooting, and I'm not familiar with this story. So talk to us about what happened. You were near one, or you narrowly missed one?
Yeah. So this is about 10 years ago now. I got to plug in my computer. One second.
Yeah, go ahead. No worries.
Sorry.
This is the part where I make excuses to our listeners and viewers that I'm terrible at editing. And the best I can do is bleep out a bad word here and there. So this is just going to be on the show. You're plugging in your computer. Okay. I'm sorry. No worries.
Sorry. So about 10 years ago, there was a mass shooting at the Clackamas Town Center Mall in Portland. And I was going to meet a friend at the mall to go dress shopping. There was a formal event coming up and she wanted to go dress shopping to find something. Mm-hmm. And so we were going to meet at the mall, and I was about three, four blocks from the mall when she called me and she said, "Hey, I just got a flat tire. I'm going to call AAA, but I don't want to be by myself. You know, will you come hang out with me while I wait for the tow truck?" So I turned around and I found her and I sat with her waiting for the guy to come and do the roadside assistance thing. And when we were waiting, police cars started flying by, lots of police cars, ambulances, sirens just left and right. And, you know, we could actually see the mall entrance from where we were. And so while we were sitting on the side of the road waiting for AAA or whatever it was, that's when the shooting went down. And had she not gotten that flat tire, we would have been in the mall at that end of the mall. Oh, wow. When it happened, it it was just the grace of God. Honestly, there's no other way that I believe it was God keeping an eye on us. The newsletter, the local news channels had been talking about it for several days, as you can imagine. And one local news station, kind of went off script one time, and all the local channels, they always kind of follow the same script and they talk about the same stories and they kind of come from the same perspective. But one local news channel, went off script a little bit, and they had a guest who they'd blurred his face, and he was a concealed carry holder in the mall that day. And he actually had locked eyes with the shooter and drew his gun and pointed it at the shooter, but he didn't take a shot because he didn't have a clear shot. And the active shooter saw him do that. And that's when he turned around, went and hid, and ended his own life. And after hearing that story, it made me realize that it was time for me to go and get my concealed weapons permit again and start really taking this pretty seriously. And my husband at the time, he wasn't really a gun guy. We had a Remington 870 for, you know, sporting clays, but he really wasn't a gun guy and wasn't hot on the idea of me carrying a gun. And I had had my permit for 4 years after I ended my abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. But then I let it expire and I felt safe and I didn't really think of it again until this happened. And I'd been telling him, like, I need to go get another gun. I need to go get my permit again. You know, this could have been me. And he was just not hot on the idea. Well, about 3 days later, I was pulling into my driveway in the middle of the afternoon. And there were a couple of guys standing in the front yard, like on the side. And there was this Jeep backed up to the side yard. And we were living in a rented house, and I was thinking, at first I thought it was the landscape crew, but they didn't look like the same people. So I was sitting in my car, in my driveway, trying to figure out what these guys were doing. And there was a stack of paver bricks against the side of the house, and the landlord was going to be putting in a pathway. And the guy, like, there was four or five of them. And one guy was taking the bricks and handing it to the guy next to him. That guy was taking it, handing it to the next guy. And then that guy was taking it and loading it into the back of this Jeep and, you know, stealing paving bricks. And the whole time there was somebody in the driver's seat of the car. And I pulled up and I'm just, you know, I'm looking around trying to figure out, like, what is happening? Who are these people? What's going on? Mm-hmm. And as I'm sitting there, they come over and they surround my car, and there's all, like, right at my car. And the guy next, like, right at the driver's side was, like, trying to open the door. And my car, fortunately, the doors were locked, but he was trying to get in. And when I had seen them walk over, I instinctively went and, like, hit my hand on the lock button, and it was already locked, but I missed the button and I hit the window button. And so the rear passenger side window went down about yay far, before I pulled my hand off. And there was the guy on that side of the door that was, like, sticking his hand in, like, trying to get his arm in to unlock the door. And so I freaked out. I'm like, okay, these are not the landscapers. They're trying to get me. And so I called my then husband, who was inside the house. He was actually on the couch taking a nap when this happened. And I called him and I was like, I'm outside. There's some guys out here. They're trying to get me. Come help me. And he was groggy, like, what are you talking about? I'm outside and there's these guys trying to get me, like, help me. And so next thing I know, the garage door comes rolling up and my German Shepherd come running out underneath the garage door before my husband did. And he walks out with this phone in one hand and the shotgun in the other. And I'm sure we didn't even have any ammo in the house. I think it was just empty shotgun. But, you know, he's got it leveled at the guy closest to me, and the guy looks at him and just doesn't even blink an eye. And it wasn't until my dog came over and bit that guy that he started to step back. And then they all kind of, like, slowly, like, casually stroll back to the Jeep that they were in. And then my dog went after another guy and bit him. And that's when they like started to hustle and got in the car and drove away. And after they had left, we finally got through to 911, and they basically told us like, well, no crime has been committed, so we're not going to send an officer out. And I was like, well, how about trespassing? How about property, petty theft? How about harassment and or attempted assault? I mean, what do you mean no crime was committed? They
right.
But there was a police substation 3 blocks away, and they didn't even come.
This is Portland PD?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
About how long ago was this? I'm curious.
About 10 years ago.
Excuse me, folks. I talked to Stephen Gutowski yesterday. We were both coughing our heads off into the mic. It's been a trend lately. I apologize.
There's something going on.
Yeah, I mean, the minute someone, some unwanted third party, pulls on the door handle of your occupied vehicle, that's attempted burglary. Someone reaching inside the car, same thing. Like, there's plenty of crimes that got committed by these guys. Trespassing, theft. I could think of a few more if I had more time, I'm sure. But the idea they wouldn't send anyone out. I always just shake my head when I hear stuff like that. That, you know, and it's almost always like here in Tucson, if you call the Tucson police for a relatively minor thing, there's a better than average chance they're not coming out. They're not going to show up. They're stretched too thin. But you go out to, you know, Oro Valley or Marana or Sarita or wherever in the suburbs, and the police will come out. If you need help blowing your nose, they will send a unit out. You know what I mean? So where you live makes a big difference as far as the kind of police service that you can expect. So after this, you went from someone who was considering re-upping their CCW and buying a gun to being a firearms instructor and a chief safety officer. That's a big leap. So it was that the incident that sort of made you decide, okay, I need to do this. This needs to be more of a focus of mine rather than just something that I do to protect myself.
Yeah. Well, it was that incident that convinced my husband that I probably getting a gun was a good idea. And so I joined a local range. I was at a ladies' night, and I met a couple of ladies, and they invited me out to a different range where they host a ladies' night, and which is now the place that I work. And they invited me to learn skills, and it was holster draw skills, defensive shooting type skills. And I didn't know it at the time, but the lady, her name's Catherine, and the lady who ran that is a national competitor, 3-gun, USPSA. She's a serious shooter. Nice. And she has learned from some of the really big names in the country, Seeklander, Ayub, Givens. And so I didn't know at the time, but I was learning from somebody who was a very skilled, talented shooter and instructor. And that was just how I got started. And after a couple of years, I kind of started helping them run the line and help teach. And then I started teaching friends how to shoot. I had a very close friend who started going through a ugly, messy divorce. And I taught her how to shoot because she was kind of afraid of her husband. And that's when I realized, like, this is something I really need to be doing, not just on the side, because, you know, my full-time job was a graphic designer, right? So creative background, not a military law enforcement background.
Right.
But I started taking this really, really seriously, and I was training, you know, several times a month and now helping teach others. And then the company that I was at, they got bought out and I got laid off. And part of the layoff was that they were going to pay for their employees for 2 years to go to college and living stipend and all that stuff to get retrained to go back into the workforce. So I was now being paid to stay at home, earn my bachelor's degree. I had my associates already. So I'm staying home, earning my bachelor's degree online with all the time in the world to do something. And, nice. That's when I decided I'm going to go get my instructor certification and really pursue this. And that's when I started my training company. It's been 5 or 6 years now that I started that officially. And I started getting tied into the range because they needed help with some graphic design at the range. And so I started volunteering my time there. So they sort of knew me. And then once I got my instructor certification, I asked the guy in charge, I was like, hey, how do I start doing this officially? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found a couple of instructors that I kind of shadowed and interviewed and watched for a while. And then the guy that runs the range told me, like, we have an in-house team. You need to go talk to this guy over here. He actually needs somebody. And so I just blindly approached this guy and said, hey, I hear you need an instructor. And this is me. This is who I am. And, so I started training with that team. And again, top-notch training team. Learn from some of the industry's greatest as well. And so that's how I got started, was as an Align instructor and then teaching. When I graduated from college, they convinced me to come on full time. And so I had been working as a range safety officer on the team. There's about 20 people on the team, and I started working there a couple days a month, and they offered me the full time job. So I was going to be chief RSO and continue to do the graphic design for them as well. And so that's been about 4 years now that I've been full time, in this industry. And I started a Girl in a Gun chapter. Right now it's the only Oregon chapter. So I work with ladies on that. Excuse me.
That's okay. Welcome to the coffin club.
So that's how I got started in it, as a full-time gig. It was kind of a slow transition. And just by being in the right place at the right time and knowing the right people, I started learning from some really well-respected instructors in the area. And, now that's what I do.
So if someone did want to come train with you, how would they find you? How would they look you up to come take some classes, and what sort of classes do you offer as an FI?
Anything from basic handgun, intermediate handgun. I do some action shooting, defensive style shooting classes. I do a lot of private lessons. I find that newer shooters are more comfortable one-on-one than they are in a group class. Most people can just find me on my website, which is pacwestdefense.com. Mm-hmm. And I've got a list of my training classes there. I do a monthly CHL class. I just started offering a concealed carry 101 class, which is a how to, if you will, like after the permit, now what, right? So it's
right.
How to pick a gun, how to pick a holster, how to pick where on body to carry, learning how to draw, learning why this position might be faster, knowing the legal side of things, which I talk about the legal side of things in my CHL class. But that's not a requirement for people to come to this one. So I again talk about the legal side of things, rules of engagement, if you will, self-defense versus murder, what you can and cannot do legally in the state, awareness, avoidance, de-escalation techniques. So you try to avoid being in that situation in the first place, and just getting people comfortable with how to carry, because I've met so many people who've had their permit for years, but have never actually carried because they don't really know how to get started or they're nervous about it. And so this class that I'm offering now kind of helps bridge that gap so they can figure out how to carry, where to carry, what to carry, when to use it, when not to use it, and how to practice.
That sounds very comprehensive, which I love, by the way, because frequently, you know, the idea of telling people things like, you know, what's the best position for them to carry in, or when can or can't you draw a gun for a defensive use? The difference between legitimate self-defense and borderline murder or actual murder? John always gets the question after his talks. There'll always be one guy, you know, the guy I'm talking about, who walks up and goes, well, can I shoot him if he's running out the front door with my TV? And they're like, you can. Absolutely, you can. You can do anything you want. You may end up in jail, though, so I wouldn't recommend it. And we emphasize, obviously, you know this, we emphasize the difference between can I, should I, and must I pull the trigger. That's a big deal for us. So, listen, I don't want to forget First of all, ladies and gentlemen, it's PacWest Defense. That's PACW. There's no K, in case you're wondering. PacWestDefense.com. And there is a phone number here. It's called the hotline, thehotline.org. And it is if you or I would imagine someone you know is in a bad situation, domestic violence related, the number to call is 800-799-7233. And I will endeavor to leave all of this in the show notes. So if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple, it should be in the description as well. You can also text the word START to 88788, and that will start a text conversation with someone who can hopefully give you some advice and some direction if you are in a bad situation with domestic violence. And remember what Lisa said, if you see the signs, you know good and well if the thing is leading in a bad direction. Don't ignore it. Don't minimize it. Don't normalcy bias yourself into the hospital, because you would rather things aren't what they are. If they are that way, recognize it and reach out, get some help from one of the numbers that I mentioned, or, you know, a trusted friend, but get yourself out of that situation sooner than later. Cause it rarely, rarely does this sort of thing get better. Rarely usually it's the male half. Rarely do they get counseling and actually get help and actually, you know, figure out what their triggers are and get better and become a model husband or boyfriend. It's almost unheard of. So you're not going to change him. He is what he is, and he's gonna stay that way. And so you need to extricate yourself as sooner as possible, sooner than later. Lisa, was there anything I left out? I don't want to leave anything out here. We're up over an hour now. This is a long one, which is great. It was full of good information.
Thank you. Just the message I want to tell anybody out there is, you know, if you're in a situation that you sometimes wonder if it's okay, just ask yourself, do you want your mom experiencing this? Do you want your best friend experiencing this? Would you want your daughter to experience this? And if the things you're experiencing is something you wouldn't want your loved ones to tolerate, then you shouldn't be tolerating it either.
Great words ending on. Again, very brave of you to come on and talk about this, Lisa. This is only the second time you've done this. If you haven't seen her over on Defenders USA with Laura Thorson, who's over there just killing it, doing a great job, give them a plug as well. Go check that interview out as well. And everything else that Laura does is tremendous. So, Lisa, again, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.